From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Like that? It's Brave Combo, a band that started off playing polkas, send-ups of polkas, and polka versions of rock hits. Now they play ethnic dance music from around the country and polka versions of rock hits. We have a concert with Brave Combo on today's Fresh Air. Also, John Lurie tells us why his music is no longer fake jazz. Lurie leads the band The Lounge Lizards. He starred in the film Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law, and also wrote the music for the movies. And critic at large Laurie Stone looks at a couple of comedy events from the past week, Andrew Dice Clay on Saturday Night Live, and Comedy Relief on HBO. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker is meeting today in Moscow with Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze in an effort to have some substantive agreements ready for the upcoming superpower summit. The talks are aimed at overcoming differences on the Baltics, arms control, and human rights. The two sides confirmed today that they were exploring new approaches to long-range nuclear weapons cuts. Baker said today that he presented new proposals to Shevardnadze earlier this month in Bonn, and the foreign minister told reporters that the Soviets also have something new to present. South Africa's government has announced that segregation will end at most hospitals in that country. In making the announcement, the health minister said too many white hospitals are underutilized, while most black hospitals are overcrowded. The BBC's Mike Wooldridge reports from Johannesburg.
The announcement means that more than 240 hospitals are desegregated immediately. There are a further 44 white hospitals which fall under a different government department, and an announcement about the future of these hospitals is expected later in the week. Giving the reasons for the move, Dr. Fenter said there was a surplus of 11,700 beds for whites in hospitals across the country and a shortage of 7,000 beds for blacks. Black hospitals, as the minister pointed out, are regularly overflowing with patients, some of whom have to sleep on the floor. The segregation of hospitals has over the years led to situations where seriously ill patients have had to travel miles further than necessary in order to go to a hospital for their particular racial group. And last year, in the apartheid defiance campaign conducted by the Mass Democratic Movement, hospitals were the initial target, the demand being made that anyone should be able to go to their nearest hospital.
Mike Wooldridge in Johannesburg. The Senate is nearing passage of a bill that would help cities cope with the AIDS epidemic. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The bill would make $600 million in federal grants available to cities with more than 2,000 AIDS cases each. The money would be for hospitals and healthcare facilities that serve large numbers of poor people. The bill would prohibit money from being used in states that start needle exchange programs for intravenous drug users. The bill is almost certain to pass since it has more than two-thirds of the Senate, 67, as co-sponsors. A similar bill has been cleared by the appropriate committee in the House and is awaiting action by the full chamber there. That bill would authorize spending of more than $800 million a year on AIDS health care. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Talks on the future of U.S. military bases in the Philippines faltered today after Philippine negotiators demanded $222 million in back lease payments from Washington. Philippine delegates to the talks said the U.S. debt could jeopardize prospects for extending the lease on the six bases, which expires in September of next year. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 3 points to close at 2,819.62. That was moderate trading of 160 million shares. This is NPR. President Bush made an urgent appeal to Congress today for quick approval of $800 million in aid for Nicaragua and Panama. Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro said today that her country is essentially bankrupt, and she asked for an emergency loan to keep the government afloat for the next 30 days. President Bush said that he can't approve a loan for Nicaragua because it can't provide assurances of repayment. House and Senate negotiators have resumed efforts to reach a compromise on the aid measure. Violeta Chamorro's government has begun negotiations with Nicaragua's striking state workers, but much of Managua remains paralyzed. Robert Meyerowitz reports from Managua.
The new Nicaraguan government reversed its position and began negotiations with striking workers from the nation's public sector unions. So far, the government has offered workers a 120% salary increase versus the 200% they've been demanding, and the government has promised no reprisals against strikers who return to work. Meanwhile, Nicaragua's telephone service, international airport, banks, government ministries, public schools, and much of its public transport system all remain shut down. Many workers joined the strike late last week when President Violeta Chamorro suspended a public service law which protected their jobs. Mrs. Chamorro's government subsequently declared the strike illegal, but failed to dislodge strikers by using riot police. Now, union leaders say the government has agreed to review parts of the public service law with an eye towards reinstating them. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
The U.S. Embassy in El Salvador expressed disappointment today over court rulings that dropped charges against most of the suspects in two controversial criminal cases. In separate rulings, judges dropped charges against 6 of 8 men charged in a 1986 kidnapping and against 10 of 11 soldiers accused of executing peasant farmers during a 1988 military operation. The Bush administration has said it considered the cases an important test of the country's justice system. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the great music pleasures in life is rediscovering a kind of music you'd written off as square or corny. The band that helped rescue the polka for some of us is Brave Combo, and they're here for a concert. Carl Finch organized the band in 1979. There was a heavy dose of irony in their versions of Who Stole the Kishka, but the deeper he got into polkas, the more genuine his affection became. Polkas have led Brave Combo to other ethnic dance musics, and they've managed to turn an old Doors hit into a polka and a Christmas carol into a cha-cha. At the same time, they do oddball versions of seemingly unredeemable pop tunes like The Poor People of Paris. We have the founder of the group, Carl Finch, on accordion, piano, and vocals, Jeffrey Barnes on tenor saxophone and clarinet, Bubba Hernandez on bass, tuba, and vocals, and Mitch Marine on percussion. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. Carl, would you introduce the first tune?
Yeah, this is Jesusita en Chihuahua. It's a traditional Tex-Mex polka, and it goes like this.
1, 2, 3.
Okay, that's Brave Combo, and while Carl is taking off the accordion and sitting down at the piano, I'll tell you that they record on Rounder Records, and their most recent album is called Humansville. That's great stuff. Were polkas ever forced on you before you started liking them?
No, not at all. In fact, there was a kid that lived two doors down from me who had the accordion forced on him, and I would listen to him practice Lady of Spain or whatever, and would think what an unfortunate little fellow he was. But then later on, and it's funny, I would keep thinking back to that because when I think about how I didn't have the accordion growing up, and he did, and I felt sorry for him. Now I wish that I had some very basic accordion instruction when I was younger. But I've sort of fell into the polka, during college.
How?
shopping bargain bins, going to stores and that sold primarily cutouts, and where I could find records for $3 for $1, and a lot of the records were ethnic records.
I think the next piece we're going to hear is written by Bubba Hernandez, who's the bass player and tubist with the band, and I think you're going to be singing on this as well. Would you introduce it for us?
Okay, this is Laura Cha-Cha-Cha, and it's by us.
It's a cha-cha. Ready? One, a two, a one, two, cha-cha-cha.
You know what I'd like to do? Since you play so many different ethnic dance musics, I'd really like to ask each member of the band what your ethnic background is and if there's a kind of music that you grew up hearing that you either did or didn't like a whole lot when you were young. Bubba, you wrote the last piece. Can we start with you?
Yeah. I'm Mexican-American. I'm from San Antonio and grew up listening to everything. A lot of musicals and, of course, a lot of Mexican music. And came up to North Texas State and did a jazz education there and ran into my fellow members here.
Mitch Marine, drummer with the band.
Well, I'm from Peoria, Illinois, and so I guess I was brought up on Southern rock and Aerosmith, basically. And
a long way from the beer barrel polka.
Very long way. And then when I went to college, started listening to jazz, and then went to North Texas State, moved down to Denton, and joined the band and started really listening to ethnic music and a lot more stuff.
Jeffrey Barnes, tenor saxophonist and clarinetist.
Okay, my family's from Ohio. We're, I suppose, mainly German and British Isles and American Indian. I listened to classical music coming up and then kind of got to be a blues fanatic when I turned 14.
Carl? And Carl Finch is the founder of the band, piano and accordion.
Let's see. I grew up in Texarkana and started my first rock and roll band in the seventh grade and listened to a lot of Yardbirds, a lot of the British rock and British blues. That was the main influence. Jeff Beck was always a big influence on me. Then I went away to college and decided I wasn't going to play music anymore. I was going to get a degree in art, so I got a couple of degrees in art. decided I didn't want to do that as a profession, and started kind of abandoning all the things that I thought were right and proper in my life, and started looking into new directions for value structure, and kind of discovered that there was a lot of great music out there that I'd written off, and really no background at all until I kind of was led in the direction of this new music.
Well, I want to hear some more of the music of Brave Combo, but first, let's take a short break, and then we'll continue our concert with Brave Combo playing ethnic dance music and some things, some surprises. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
It's a Fresh Air concert with Brave Combo, and they play dance music of all kinds, and they record on Rounder Records. And Carl, want to introduce the next piece for us?
Okay, this is a waltz. It's a Polish waltz. It's called Breslau, and we just happened to find this from one of those records that I found in a bargain bin. It goes like this.
Brave Combo, and you know, I'm sitting here listening to all this great dance music, and I'm thinking, I could probably tell you all stories that would make your hair stand up about cha-chas and, and polkas and merengues from catered affairs gone by, and I just am so excited about hearing the music kind of taken out of the kind of bad union musician context that I heard it growing up. But you know, I'm wondering, like Bubba, for instance, if growing up in a Mexican American family, if you didn't have to. If that music never had that kind of bad, scary effect on you that it had on me, for instance?
Oh, no, not really. I mean, as long as the music was played good, you know, I think I was pretty open to anything that would come by me.
So, I mean, it wasn't considered square in your family to do a cha-cha or a polka?
No, because I think a lot of youth still, you know, if like in the bands I played with, if you played a wedding or if you went to a wedding or a debut, the band would play half top 40 and half polkas and cumbias and Latin music, and it's required of you, or you require that of them too. You know, that's what you want to hear.
We have a pretty diverse ethnic background represented in the band here. Can I just hear what the worst songs any of you have ever had to play for weddings have been, coming from your different backgrounds?
Well, sometimes we play those worst songs. Part of our live show is to, and not so much to form value judgments, but to play certain kind of wimpy songs in a wimpy style. You know, we do that as a, just sort of to juxtapose that against playing something as tight as possible. But we do sort of wimpy arrangements now of The Look of Love or Tie a Yellow Ribbon or There's Got to Be a Morning After or Feelings. Any of these things.
Daddy's Little Girl.
Yeah. Well, I kind of like Daddy's
I
Little
like
Girl.
I like Daddy's Little
yeah,
Girl.
Sure, it's a nice song.
We like, I guess we kind of even like these songs.
What's amazing is once you start playing this stuff, you do break down all these things you attach to it, and you start to hear great things in songs that you would never have liked. For instance, I really like the song Sweet Pea now a lot. I even like Tommy Rowe's arrangement of Sweet Pea. It's a really tight thing. There was a time when I would have thought that was the dumbest, stupidest song ever written. Knock Three Times, I think, is a great song now. Even that arrangement, that performance, Tony Orlando. I don't know if I'd want to hang out with Tony Orlando, but I like that recording of that song now, and there was a time that I didn't.
Can you do a few bars of one of these songs for us?
Oh, sure. What, maybe, you want to hear a funny arrangement of Proud Mary, for instance?
Sure, but that's maybe too good of a song. I mean,
How we play it. Here we go. Let's do a little bit of that.
Everybody do the rock and roll.
We play this in rock and roll clubs as quietly as possible. Okay? Here we go.
Okay.
One, two, three, four.
Rock and roll!
Fabulous.
So it goes like that. It's a good icebreaker too. Once people see how miserable we can be, then they, you know, everybody sort of breaks the ice and we're having a good time.
What are you likely to go into after that?
Maybe we'll go into a Chemochem, for instance, which is an Armenian folk song that we really, really, really like.
Did anybody ever play as square as that in real life?
I did a lot of hotel gigs.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, we saved Bubba from his lounge gig.
Yeah,
that's what he was doing.
I got through college playing hotels. And honky-tonks.
Now, on one of your records, you do The Doors, People Are Strange as a polka.
Right.
You want to do that for us?
Okay, well, this is People Are Strange, originally by The Doors, and we played as a polka, but it's actually a hora and would be very appropriate for a bar mitzvah. It's kind of a circle dance. Everybody grab hands, and here we go. Ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven now when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange, people are strange. When you're a stranger, faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Unwanted, streets are uneven. Now when you're down, when you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. Yeah.
Terrific. Carl, what made you realize that People Are Strange would make a perfect horror?
What made me realize that?
Yeah.
Well,
why'd you pick on that song?
Well, it seemed to be, you know, it was kind of slow. The Doors did it kind of slow, and I thought, well, one thing we can do is make it faster. And then we made it faster and we made it faster, and now we perform it about that tempo live, and it seemed a little fast for a traditional polka unless you're very, very good. So it looked more like something that you would see as a circle dance. And also it's in a minor key, which sort of lends itself better to that kind of thing.
Of course.
But there are some things that don't work. You know, we try other songs sometime as polkas or horrors or cha-chas, and they don't work at all. And so we don't always just take it because it seems like a novel thing to do.
Can I get you to play a few measures of a failure?
Of a failure? Let me see. Well, what is it that we've done recently that didn't work? I remember, I know one. Bus stop, a wet day, she's there. I say we share my umbrella. Bus stop, bus goes, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. That sounds like just people are strange again.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Well, it does at first, and then the more we would play it, the more we realized that, you know, it's just not as strong, and there's too many words, and the message seems different. Somehow the message of people are strange is not so specific as a song like Bus Stop.
How about Hey Jude, Cha-Cha-Cha?
Well,
that works.
Would you like to hear a measure? This is pretty funny.
Yeah.
One of our fans from Oklahoma City came up to me and said, "Hey, Carl, I know a song that'll work as a cha-cha," and we hear that a lot. You know, people are always wanting us to work up Grateful Dead polkas, which we've never found a song yet that really works for a Grateful Dead polka. But he said, "Hey Jude, Cha-Cha," and we thought about it, and it goes like this. One, a two, a one, two.
It is amazing. Has the reception your band has gotten changed in the past 11 years? Do people get what you're doing more than when you started?
I think so. I think that with world music kind of coming up also, people are more accustomed to odd sounds like the accordion or someone singing in a foreign language. Those have been the main obstacles to overcome as much as just the forms, just the fact that it's a polka. But having someone actually pay attention and listen without laughing to Bubba singing in Spanish or to hear us try to do our best with Polish or Armenian or whatever. At first, I think it was novelty to most people, and now I think people realize that we sincerely try to play these things as close to form as possible. And by that, I think that our acceptance has grown.
Well, I had a ball with the concert, and I want to thank you
so much
for performing. It was just really a lot of fun.
It's our pleasure.
The band is Brave Combo, and they record on Rounder Records. They have a few albums. The latest is called Humansville. And the members of the band, again, are Carl Finch. He's the founder. We heard him on accordion, piano, and vocals. Jeffrey Barnes, tenor saxophone and clarinet. Bubba Hernandez, we heard him on bass, tuba, and vocals. And Mitch Marine on drums. Thanks to all of you. Carl, would you play us out?
Oh, okay, this is the Satellite Polka by one of our heroes, Larry Chesky from Holyoke, Massachusetts. One, two, three, four. Woo! Woo!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's film music by John Lurie. Lurie starred in the movies Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise and wrote the music for the movies as well. And he leads the band The Lounge Lizards. Coming up, John Lurie tells us why he no longer thinks of his music as fake jazz. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone on this past week's two big comedy events, the Comic Relief Benefit for the Homeless and Andrew Dice Clay's appearance on Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that he has not yet decided whether to extend special trading status to China. The president's decision must come by June 3rd. Today on Capitol Hill, members of Congress heard arguments for and against continuing the economic relationship. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Opponents of keeping trade concessions on Chinese imports argued the Chinese regime would be encouraged to continue its policy of repression. The Bush administration is operating with a double standard, according to former U.S. Ambassador to China Winston Lord, promoting democracy in Eastern Europe, South Africa, and Latin America, while ignoring it in China. Lord argued for extending the so-called most favored nation status with China, but only in the context of a broader policy aimed at improving the government's human rights policies. But other China experts and American and Hong Kong business representatives told a congressional panel that keeping strong trading ties has helped keep the Chinese government open, helped the very people the U.S. wants to help. President Bush made it clear today that those arguments are important to him, but added he did not want to send the Chinese leaders the signal that human rights do not matter. I'm Cokie Roberts, The Capitol.
The Prime Minister of Lithuania goes to Moscow tomorrow, bearing a new offer for negotiations on independence for the Baltic Republic. This trip coincides with Secretary of State James Baker's talks with Kremlin officials, where the Baltic crisis is already a prominent topic. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Prime Minister Kazimierz Prunskynia will try to see Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev tomorrow. If the Soviet leader turns her down, she'll leave him a copy of her offer, endorsed today by the Lithuanian legislature. The lawmakers say they'll agree to freeze laws passed since their March 11th Declaration of Independence, but only if Moscow will agree to negotiate Lithuania's freedom from the Soviet Union. Baker raised the Kremlin's conflict with the Baltic republics during his first meeting tonight with Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze. He said he hoped the two sides could find a peaceful solution. But it's not encouraging, he said, that there's no dialogue going on now. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
In Washington, President Bush said today that the standoff between Moscow and the Baltic republics over their independence moves is putting some tension on his upcoming summit meeting with Soviet leader Gorbachev. However, Mr. Bush also told reporters that it is important to the world that the superpower talks take place. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 3 points to close at 2,819.62 on buying of some 160 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Lurie's movies and music have given him the image of the ultimate downtown New York bohemian. He starred in the downbeat films Stranger Than Paradise and Down by Law. Lurie also scored both films. For the past 10 years, he's performed and recorded with his band, The Lounge Lizards. Their brand of jazz was bathed in irony, but a lot of the irony is gone in their new record, Voice of Chunk. This is the opening track, Bob the Bob, composed by Lurie. He's featured on alto saxophone. His brother, Evan Lurie, is on piano.
Thank you.
compositions on your new record, like Bob the Bob, sound very influenced by world music. Have you been traveling?
Yeah, actually, it was strange. I did this little thing in Last Temptation of Christ, and
you were an apostle, right?
Yeah, I was St. James. I'm basically the beard behind Willem Dafoe is my part. I met these guys called Ganawa musicians who I'd heard about before and started playing with them. But Bob the Bob I had actually written about 2 months before that. So when I started playing with these Ganawa musicians, I found things in my own playing rather than that I was copying them. So it was kind of more, organic for me or something.
So this was in Morocco while you were shooting The Last Temptation of Christ?
Yeah.
Did you sit in with them at all?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that happened was I was looking for Ganawa musicians, and I was introduced to a bunch of guys who were not... Ganawa's got a whole spiritual background behind it. It's not just a musical form. It's a whole lifestyle, which I don't know enough about to tell you. But there was I met some phony Ganawas, so to speak. Then I met a French guy who was a fan of my band who was doing some kind of... his military service in Morocco for some weird reason. And he had... These guys come to my room and we play almost every night. So, yeah, I got to play with them a lot.
I was wondering if you felt more comfortable sitting in with them than you have with jazz musicians in America.
You know, I'm not the guy to sit in. I've always shied away from this thing of sitting in. It always seems to be a disaster. Also, the way I play doesn't really, you know, I'm not really good for a cutting contest. As I play more, I play less and less and less. I'm not really like, you know... My bebop technique is sorely lacking. So I guess I did feel more comfortable with them. I like the reason that they play music more. I like the essence of the music more. That's where my heart is, you know?
How is the reason that they play music different from the reason you think jazz musicians play music?
Well, I think I can't say why jazz musicians actually play music. For me, with jazz, I'm only really interested in the big voices and the people like Coltrane or Monk or Dolphy. But then all these hundreds of people who sound like someone else or a synthesis of three or four styles, I have no interest in this. And I don't know why they play, actually.
The sound on your new record is in some ways a different tone than the ironic, moody, film noirish kind of music you've made a lot of in the past.
Yeah,
is this like a new direction you're heading in?
I think it's more real somehow. I think I the film noir stuff was a little bit of a pose, I'm afraid to say, or something, or just you know you try and find your voice. You know, you spend a long time trying to find your voice in whatever you do, if whatever art form, or I suppose no matter what it is, you find it. And so I feel like I finally found it. I mean, I'm very proud of the last album. I never really had that feeling before where I would come out of the studio and say, oh, I'm really proud of what this was. And this one, I'm really proud. And that's why I'm doing the business thing like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's ironic in a way that the place where you feel you lost the pose was going to another country and getting a sense of the music there.
Yeah, see, I find in America people tend to play music as a career, and I don't think of music like that. And I think that that's very scary if you think about it. Music is supposed to be something more than that. It's supposed to be something involved with magic and something involved with religion in some kind of way, and I think that that's really important. And in America, we seem to have lost that thread.
There is one noirish type track on your new record. I'm thinking of The Hanging.
The Hanging. I almost didn't put The Hanging on there because I felt like it didn't quite go with the rest of the material. But, you know, when you're sequencing something, I found a spot that it would fit, you know?
Tell me about writing it, when you wrote it, what you had in mind.
The Hanging in particular?
Yeah.
The Hanging was one of those ones where I was sitting on my bed watching TV. And I had the saxophone out, you know, and I was just sort of playing, and somebody said, oh, that was really nice. And I said, really? And so then I made something into it. It was no big deal. It's a little Mingus-y. And I like this thing where, I always like that thing where you've got a flatted third and then you have a raised seventh. I know that that's not going to help you, but this sort of Harlem Nocturne-y kind of sound.
you coined the term fake jazz to describe what you started doing early on in your career. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I don't know. It was a really unfortunate thing I did. It was, you know, we had just thrown the Lounge Lizards together on the first occasion that we played. My brother had just moved to New York, and somebody had asked me what was a good band to open for somebody, and said, oh, my band, not having a band. We threw this thing together, 6 hours of rehearsal, and we played. And for some reason, I had been known a little bit for, I had directed these Super 8 movies, and Ardo Lindsay was in the band, and he had DNA, and Anton Fear was in the band. And he was in the Feelies, so we were sort of well-known, but it was a joke the first night. And we finished, and suddenly it was this immense success. People went absolutely crazy, and there was all these people rushing into the dressing room after the show. I said, what do you call this music? And I said, oh, it's fake jazz. And it stuck, which, you know, if I had known it was going to stick, I would have given a little more thought to it. But
what were the bad repercussions of having it stick?
Well, see, I'm a little bit, you know, it's particularly, this is 1979 we're talking about, and the what was happening in the jazz world was just the most, people who were, either it was really incredibly indulgent stuff where people thought that they were playing like Coltrane, but they were just really doing this sort of masturbatory jazz, or else they were playing music that you could, you know, eat steak and drink wine to, and neither one was particularly interesting to me, and so I was... Because basically my influence was jazz, but I didn't want to be involved in the jazz world. It seemed like a really sure death, not just financially, but also it was like jazz was a dirty word by at this point in time.
Your early days with the Lounge Lizards coincided with the punk rock, and I was wondering if that was good timing for you, because like you played a lot of the rock clubs. And, like, technique wasn't really highly prized in punk. I mean, it wasn't about technique. It was about the sound and about the energy and attitude, in a way.
Yeah, but in a way, it was bad because I'm very serious about music, you know, and I do have a certain reverence to jazz. And so that it came along in punk times. What basically happened is that I had a career before while I should have been woodshedding. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that I was suddenly in the public, but I couldn't really play that well. And so it helped and it hurt.
Do you feel like your music changed as you started getting more at home with the instrument and more?
No, I got more at home. I got more at home running the band and making the band work. Mm-hmm. I think that was more the thing.
Musician and actor John Lurie is my guest. He starred in the movies Down by Law and Stranger Than Paradise and wrote the scores for the films. His band, the Lounge Lizards, has a new record called Voice of Chunk. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Musician and actor John Lurie is my guest. Is it true that you had your two front teeth knocked out?
The left one, yeah.
Oh, the left one?
Yeah.
By a bouncer?
But he wasn't a legitimate bouncer. I don't know what the deal was. It was very shady people. Suddenly, this club had a whole new set of bouncers working there, and God knows who they were. But they decided to beat me up.
Were you playing there or training?
No, no. I was hanging out there. It was late. I was there, and it's a silly story. They had these two bathrooms upstairs, which were never delegated to which one was a men's room and which one was a woman's room. And so my girlfriend actually had to go to the bathroom, which was a rare occasion for using the bathrooms in one of these clubs. And I was holding the door while she went to the bathroom because there was no locker. And so there's a bang on the door, and I said, just a minute. And they say, no men in the women's room, which was quite a shock to me because nobody had ever had any idea that this was actually the women's room. And I said, I'm just holding the door. You'll have to wait. And when I opened the door, there were four guys standing there, and they were all 5'10", and they all weighed 250 pounds, and they all had the same mustaches, same haircuts, and same jackets. And I said, look at that. They all look alike. And so one of them punched me. And then one of them kicked me, and then I got up like I was going to do something about it. I can't believe that. And then one of them held me, and the other one punched me in the face and knocked my tooth out.
So do you have a fake tooth now?
Yeah, but a very nice one. It's actually whiter than the rest of the teeth.
Did it change your embouchure?
Yeah, it screwed me up because I had to actually have 8 different front teeth before I could get it back. It did change my plan. It was very hard to get used to a new front tooth because, you know, the way the mouthpiece rests on your teeth, it has to be really... Your teeth get worn down to the shape of the mouthpiece. And so, switching was incredibly difficult.
Do you want to do more acting? And do you want to do more than the kind of roles that you've done? In other words, not have a certain type of character that you always play?
Yeah. I certainly would like to do something other than those kind of offbeat beatniks that I've played. But acting is not, you know, I feel a little bit like a jerk saying, yeah, I want to act. I mean, I don't really have, I haven't sort of paid my dues, you know, uh-huh. as an actor. And I really go, though I definitely am acting, I go by such a natural thing. If I could do it more, I think it could be great. But I don't do it enough. And I don't really have the time to pursue it.
Your music is really considered a part of the New York downtown scene. Where are you from?
I was born in Minneapolis. Then I moved to New Orleans when I was 6. And then I moved to Worcester, Massachusetts when I was around 10. I've been in New York forever, as far as 74 or something like that.
Now, your father had been a museum curator and college professor when you were in Minnesota, is that right?
Uh-huh.
And he was blacklisted? What for?
For being in the Communist Party. But that's not all exactly true. He wasn't really blacklisted. He just had to move around very quickly because he was in trouble. But he didn't actually get blacklisted.
And what did he do after the blacklist?
He had this idea. He did a lot of different stuff. He finally ended up doing selling Israeli bonds, of all things. Yeah, I don't know. See, my dad was this very, very secretive man, and so when he died, I didn't know that much about him, and so now I'm just sort of piecing together things about him and can't really, I don't really know what the whole deal was with my dad.
Were your parents, like, more politically motivated and goal-oriented than you were when you were young?
It's hard to say. My father was this very strange man, and when he died, I felt like that he had been a failure because he had never accomplished anything truly artistic. And apparently, he had gone, you know, to Columbia and NYU and written... They expected him to be the next James Joyce or something, as far as I could understand. And then he went to the South and organized farm workers and never actually wrote a book or anything. Now, I felt like my father was a bit of a failure when he died. Went to a wedding about 3 years after he died, and all these 60 and 70-year-old men were coming over to me and saying, your father was a real hero of mine, which kind of blew me away. But I think it instilled in me some kind of need, for example, why I'm doing the record, why I'm doing this 1-800-44-CHUNK business, is because I feel like you can't just do the work and then let it sit there and nobody knows it. You have to get it out there. It instilled some kind of drive in me to make things recognized or something.
Mm-hmm. You're selling the record through an 800 number, though I think the record's in stores now, too, isn't it?
It's in some stores, yeah. But mm-hmm. you can receive the record by calling 1-800-44-CHUNK, which is also the name of the record company.
What did you decide to handle it yourself?
That's a hard question. I thought it would be fun. I was just really sick of very bad distribution that I'd had before with other labels. And... I paid for this record myself because the band was just really ripe to record these things. And I knew if I started to, you know, I didn't have a label at the time. I knew that it would take, you know, it takes between the lawyers and all this stuff. It takes 3, 4, 5 months to get it ready to go, you know. And so I just decided I'll do it now. It's time, you know. And so I did it. And I thought, this is a great album. It's going to be a breeze to sell this, you know. And, of course, in Japan and in Germany and around the world, I had people bidding on it, you know, 4, 5, 6 companies in each country. And in the United States, they wouldn't return my calls, you know, or Valerie Goodman's calls, who was doing the bid. I just was kind of shocked by this because I had people really chasing me for this record. And in America, so I said, well, I'm not going to grovel. I've been around too long. There's really no reason for them to not. It's there's some kind of problem. I'm not going to take this personally. It's some kind of real problem with the system of how music is being distributed in this country. And so I'm going to just do it myself. I'll kick these guys in the pants a little bit.
Well, John Lurie, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Actor, musician, and composer John Lurie. The new Lounge Lizards record is called Voice of Chunk. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. Robert, there's two people who I'm sure you'll be remembering today on All Things Considered.
Certainly are. We have Bob Mondello's obituary for Sammy Davis Jr., who died at 64 today, and also Jim Henson, the creator of The Muppets, remembered on All Things Considered. Also, news of West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl's decision to accelerate all German elections, that is, an election that would involve both West Germany and East Germany, the latest in the Baltic Republic's protests and attempts at independence and the counter-protests, and the results of the Pennsylvania primary, in which the abortion issue played so heavily.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Comedy got a lot of national press this past weekend, with the controversial Andrew Dice Clay hosting Saturday Night Live, while HBO cablecast the special Comic Relief. Critic Laurie Stone has these thoughts on the two events.
At the end of Comic Relief at Radio City Music Hall, Whoopi Goldberg, Billy Crystal, and Robin Williams announced that the event had raised over $3.5 million. An hour earlier, at midnight, Andrew Dice Clay had declared on air that he was donating his earnings from hosting Saturday Night Live to the homeless. He said it sheepishly, as if embarrassed to be caught out of his braggart's persona. There they were, comedy's two big stories of the week, momentarily converging. About Clay, the man who was stripped of his sexist slurs for network TV proved bland. With Clay on screen so much, I got to scrutinize him, and behold, this guy who has been assessing women's bodies as if they were meat has fat thighs. His padded shoulders could rise as high as Trump Towers, and still they wouldn't minimize the thighs. Hell hath no fury like a guy with lardy hindquarters. This one insists he's virile and that women are mindless, but even an inflatable doll could see the quivering anxiety fueling his rant. Plucky Nora Dunn, who had boycotted Saturday Night Live, showed up at Comic Relief to talk to the press. The media typically trivializes feminism, and true to form, most reporters had skewed Dunn's stand, so it seemed she was against raunch rather than bigotry. She might have explained the difference, but she was introduced with the coy prohibition that she'd only field questions about the homeless. She has a track record on this issue? Hoping to skirt the charge of grandstanding, she came off appearing to do that. But hey, self-promotion is hardly unknown at Comic Relief. In a TV interview last week, HBO's chairman and CEO Michael Fuchs said, and I'm paraphrasing, "It was great to help others, but when you could also help yourself, well, that was dying and going to heaven." He's probably sprouting wings. Comic Relief, in its 4 years of existence, has earned over $16 million, every cent of which has funded a national network of health care facilities for homeless people. This year, HBO, with the aid of Canada Dry, has picked up all expenses, totaling $2,063,710. But the show, with its enormous audience, superstar hosts, and good guy image, has also become the premier, please book me, please, please, event of the year. Who does get booked? Nearly all of the performers, who are overwhelmingly white, have solid ties to HBO. The nation's largest subscription network produces, among this year's lineup, shows starring the three hosts, Elaine Boozler, Bob Goldthwait, Alan Havey, Richard Lewis, Stephen Wright, Robert Wall, Rita Rudner, Paula Poundstone, and many others. HBO gets to write off the production costs of Comic Relief as charity, at the same time gaining 5 hours of promotion time for its talent. Downstairs in the green room at Radio City, there was elegant food catered by Tommy Tang and expensive lilies on the tables. Agents and managers talked deals, and stars blinked into the space illuminated by their celebrity auras. The scene, with its absence of want, with no trace of the predicament being campaigned for on stage, was disturbingly detached, yet entrancing, as luxury always is and is imagined being by those barred from it. Behind me, a man mused, with understandable cynicism. For 5 hours, I'm eating cake and drinking wine for the homeless.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and the author of the novel Starting with Surge. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Rich Banowitz. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Martin Landau tells us about his Oscar-nominated roles in Crimes and Misdemeanors and Tucker. And we talk about his work at the Actors Studio, teaching people like Jack Nicholson and Oliver Stone. Also, we meet poet Frank Bidart. I'm Terry Gross. I hope to join us for the next Fresh Air.